Hey witches, SOMOTHECCON 2025 is only a month away, and you don't want to miss this one because it's the last year and it's gonna be amazing. On October 18th and 19th, gather together to learn, to be in community together, and to spend time with this incredible line of both presenters, Michael A. Bryan, Rossa Crean, J. Allen Cross, Morgan Daimler, Monica Devane, and Dawn Aurora Hunt join That Witch Life Podcast's Courtney, Hillary, and Kanani and this year's keynote, Mara fucking Wilson. Yeah, we're talking Matilda herself. There will be rituals, workshops, raffles, a live Q&A with Mara, and more magic than you can possibly squeeze into your cauldron. There's still time to get tickets, so head on over to www.thatwitchlife.com to get those tickets and avoid being haunted by FOMO. I hope to see you all there.
Welcome to the Science Witch Podcast, where we explore how science and witchcraft intersect, interact, and affirm one another. I'm your co-host, Angel.
And I'm your co-host, James. And this is the 77th episode. It's a check-in with one of our favorite guests and a friend of the podcast, Nicholas Pearson. This is Nicholas's third time on the podcast. And as always, he offers up what we consider to be peak Science Witch with his thoughtful and scientifically minded spiritual guidance with crystals.
This was another one of our convos that can be placed into a playlist of how to survive and cope with the incoming fascist takeover we Americans are facing, and for everyone else, it's a cool and creative way to use crystals and protection magic. As has been our theme for the past few months, we've been inviting folks on the show with insight on how to use our magic and witchcraft for protecting ourselves spiritually, emotionally, and physically. So Nicholas is another great resource for witchifying our resistance.
I really love the part of our discussion where we talked about the environmental impact of the crystal industry, but at the same time, as Nicholas said, we don't have to scapegoat the industry when there are much bigger players out there doing much, much greater environmental damage. Anyway, he also talked about georegionalism, which is something that really interests me, you know, connecting with the earth and the stones and things that are here around me in my local area, in, here in my place of birth.
Yeah, and one of the reasons Nicholas is one of my favorite guests is because his work seamlessly blends his knowledge of both earth sciences with the spiritual dimensions of crystal magic. And this time around, we really got to dig into some pertinent topics about how to use these tools to help us lead more magical lives in a time when the existential banality is overwhelming. So, without further ado, let's get to our interview with our resident crystal daddy, Nicholas Pearson. Okay. Well, hello, everyone. Welcome to another episode of the Science Witch Podcast. Today, we have a repeat guest, friend of the podcast, Nicholas Pearson. And today, we're going to be talking about crystal protection. So, as I like to start out with every episode, Nicholas, for the folks that are not familiar with your work, would you please introduce yourself to our listeners?
Absolutely. And thank you all for having me back for a third time. It's a real treat. I am kind of a big old nerd, which I think is our target demographic anyway. But
absolutely.
Yeah, I'm in that intersection of science and spirituality, in as much that I've got a really profound love of earth science and mineralogy and crystallography and all things kind of related to the crystal sphere, if you will. But I really enjoy the way that informs and enriches my practice through the spiritual lens, the way that we see themes echoed in geological processes, but also folklore from lots of places around the world. Since the last time I joined you all, I actually got a job in academia. I work in earth science doing collections management work. It's a lot of paperwork as these jobs tend to be. But I am at my alma mater at Stetson University working for the Gillespie Museum, which is the institution where I kind of cut my teeth in earth science way back in the day. And I am kind of spearheading a project. We are a very small team of two, working through what I estimate to be about 35,000 specimens or more that will need any level of identification and conservation and preservation and restoration where possible, plus just having to build the database around all of that. So I get to use like the science part of my brain for that. And then I get to write books and teach workshops and do lots of other fun things beyond that.
Living the dream.
Yeah,
That's
it feels
awesome.
very hero's journey. Like you went out and became the crystal daddy, and now you're back to where you started.
You're gonna
Now
put that on
you
your website, Crystal Daddy.
And now you have like a professional reason to catalog all of your crystals because you
Hell
have
yeah.
an extensive crystal collection yourself.
To confess, that was the most awkward part of interviewing for the job because they're like, "Well, tell us about your collection and your expertise and your experience like maintaining your collection. What kind of database or archive or anything do you have?" And like, "Well, honestly, I don't
You
because
don't.
I don't want to do that for my day job and then come home and do that some more. But as I'm working through a collection, the earliest parts of which date back to the 1930s. And honestly, some of the pieces acquired in the 1930s are really from like the mid 18th century. So, pieces of the collection have, say, paper trails that go back quite a long time, but it's been in its current institutional home, not the same building, but the same school for almost 70 years. So that's 70 years of bad record keeping. And I've only been collecting not quite half that amount of time. I should get a head start. So, in 30 years from now, this isn't the nightmare that I'm facing at work.
Yes.
That's
Yeah.
so we're here to talk about your book, Crystal Magic, or I'm sorry, Crystal Protection. And as has been kind of the theme this year on the podcast, we have been centering this idea of witchcraft as a way to help us both survive and thrive in this late stage capitalism hellscape that we all find ourselves in. And so I know you hail from Florida. You identify in the LGBTQIA plus community. So what was the impetus for writing Crystal Magic and bringing
Crystal
it to the
protection.
If I can
sorry,
jump
crystal
in here
protection.
with a citation, just so Nicholas
Yeah, go
doesn't
ahead
have
and
to
get
do it. The actual title of Nicholas's amazing new book is Crystals for Psychic Self-Defense,
Yes.
145 Gemstones for Banishing, Binding, and Magical Protection by
Yes.
Nicholas Pearson. It is such an amazing resource. And for listeners who recently listened to our talks with Amy Blackthorne around herbal protection magic, this is a kindred to that in
Yes.
so many ways.
The companion.
The companion, the crystal companion. So, yes, with all that preface, tell us why you wanted to write this book and why you think it's important to bring it to the world right now.
So, ironically, I started this book back in maybe 2018. The project began because, I have worked in the kind of metaphysical space and crystal shops and the like for a very long time. And one of the top things that brings people through the doors is the need for safety. And that comes in a lot of forms. It can be feeling emotionally vulnerable in a social situation. It can be the kind of heightened energetic sensitivity that comes for alongside things like psychic development and, just doing your spiritual practice. And then, some of it comes from living in the late capitalist hellscape that we live in. So just seeing how frequent this request was, and knowing that I grew up as a fairly sensitive human in every meaning of that word, sensitive emotionally, sensitive psychically, sensitive energetically. And I had to learn how to navigate that for myself because I just didn't have the right resources in place. It was different when, I mean, we're all of a similar generation here. It was different when we were kids. You didn't have the internet like you've got it today. You didn't have, memified versions of this kind of stuff, really simple, bite-sized bits of info that you could digest. And so I had to do it all the hard way. And I started putting the book together just kind of predicated on this idea of needing energetic support to go about life. And then, as sometimes happens, when you decide to focus on a topic, when you decide to practice a thing, or we'll say share your expertise in it, that expertise gets challenged. And we can all understand how the world went wonky about 5 years ago, and the urgency with which people were coming to me, coming to the shop that I work in, coming to classes and things for that extra support, that extra protection, was elevated beyond anything I'd experienced. And it was so intersectional. It was so many communities of people that were feeling more vulnerable than average, that were being targeted more explicitly than before. I mean, let's not sugarcoat it. Racism, homophobia, xenophobia, it's always been there, but it certainly escalated in public view. And that sort of had an effect on the collective psyche. So I had to pump the brakes on this project a couple of times because I needed to ensure that it had the right kinds of tools to meet people in those circumstances. And then my personal life also kind of, we'll say, exploded in some ways. And some of those threats came pretty close to home. And it invited me to really reevaluate the project. Having started the book in probably late 2018, after I turned in the final edits for Crystal Basics, which we talked about in a previous episode, I anticipated that this protection book was going to be the next one that I put out, but it wasn't. Peak pandemic, I had one of those shower aha moments, shampooing my hair, as the cliche goes. And I'm like, oh, this idea for another book comes to me. And so I wrote my Flower Essence book, and that delayed the progress on this. And then I wrote my little pocket encyclopedia, and that delayed the process on this. And then, as I was really sitting through my observations, my experiences, my learning opportunities throughout that kind of peak pandemic, peak social unrest period, I really started to get to work on Crystals for Psychic Self-Defense and thinking about how I needed to meet things with more urgency. There are tools in the book that are very everyday. Hey, here's a simple crystal you can pop in your pocket and feel safer to go into the post office. Or here's something you can do if you're really energetically sensitive and crowded places like the grocery store, just not a good vibe for you. But given the need, the great need for more than just shielding, more than just spiritual hygiene, more than just the basics, I also wanted to include topics like binding magic with the help of gemstones, banishing rituals, both with and without the material objects of minerals themselves. I wanted to include things that are kind of rooted in more historical forms of practice. We don't th often think of crystals and curses and crystals and, the kind of heavy hitting magic, but I mean, the truth is that we have evidence of gems and mineral resources being used in this way for thousands of years. And I wanted to kind of draw upon those really rich historic influences and adapt them for the modern day, so that way people can visit their local crystal shop or dig through their little box of crystals and use the things that we've got available to us now. and also update the practices, because the kinds of things we might want to banish from our lives, well, I think there are some universal concepts that remain. Humans are humans, no matter when or where. We also have some pretty unique things going on in this day and age, and I wanted to serve those needs as well. So yeah, a lot of factors went in. It's the book that has taken me the longest to write. I once kind of infamously wrote a book in 27 days. I'm not going to pretend it was a draft, but it was a whole draft. And this one took the better part of 5 years to finish writing.
Yeah,
Yeah.
I mean, not to continue to mythologize you, Nicholas, but yeah, I really love that arc of taking what you needed as a younger person and then being that resource for the rest of us, or the rest of your community coming up. Yeah, that's such a powerful place to be, because it's not just like, oh, I went to a crystal show one day and bought a bunch of stuff and it's pretty. Like, there's a level of sincerity that really comes through your work that I'm starting to sort of see how that's rooted in your personal story. And I just really appreciate that.
Yeah, I have a mentor in this world, Christopher Penzack, who has said to many people over the years, when people will ask him, because he's probably seen just about any occult book that's out there. Hey, do you know of a book on such and such topic? No, but if you're looking for that book, you should probably write it. And that's kind
I
of
love that.
yeah, it's kind of where I'm at in my writing practice is, what is the book that would have served a younger Nicholas? What is a book that would have served, Nicholas 10 years ago? But also, what excites me right now? So I get to sit in this real liminal space in my work that straddles a lot of different topics and a lot of different approaches. I find that the longer I work at it, the more I do this, the deeper I want to dig. I'm not interested in writing an easy, shallow book. I really want to get into the weeds. The next couple big projects I have coming out, I've got something in there that's a little bit lighter, but my next couple big projects are like really research intensive, a lot more, we'll say, journal citations than I think your average occult book has in it. And I'm so excited about where this is going, and it's really fun to grow through this. But if I hadn't had those foundational experiences as a young queer budding occultist, without any of those labels to figure it out, this book wouldn't exist.
It's like peak science witch right there.
Yeah, and I also love what you were saying about putting in your book the kind of historical context of different crystals and minerals. I think I personally would find that very fascinating to read about.
It's my great love because, again, going back to this idea that human nature is kind of a constant force and that there is no ancient mystical path past that is somehow better than or more evolved than we are today. When we look at how we've done things before, we often arrive at very similar ideas to how we
Exactly.
now. A really great example from just like the material objects that we can find related to mineral lore. Find any deposit of obsidian that was accessible in pre-modern periods, and you will find the same kinds of objects being made from it. The physical properties of that substance lend themselves to certain kinds of uses. And if you look at cutting-edge uses for obsidian today, they're just more refined versions of the same things. We use obsidian to make scalpels now, initially for ophthalmic surgery, because you can get the edge of this volcanic glass so much straighter and cleaner and sharper than surgical stainless steel that it does less collateral damage cutting through very delicate tissues. And this incisive quality that substance has, it's not truly a crystal, it's an amorphous solid, but that incisive quality we see echoed in the folkloric applications of it, as well as in the physical objects that remain from, I mean, in some cases, tens of thousands of years ago. The idea that we can use it to cut through a force that is potentially harmful or disruptive. It's also frequently fashioned into reflective surfaces. We've got, the kind of classic obsidian mirrors from pre-colonization in Central and South America, but you can also go a couple thousand years before that to the modern day Anatolian Peninsula, to Çatalhöyük, and find much less sophisticated obsidian mirrors that were used for probably the same purposes, the same kind of inner reflective work, whether we call that scrying or conjuring spirits, or we can't presume to know what these people did with them because they didn't write it down, but there are enough clues that we can recreate some things. And of course, you go into any crystal shop today and you're going to find obsidian scrying mirrors and crystal spheres and same kinds of objects, because there really is nothing new under the sun. And for me, I find that really comforting, also really empowering, because all of these people who've lived before us innovated to the best of their ability. So we should do the same thing. Yes, be inspired by the historical record, but don't be limited to it.
I love that.
And it brings up the sort of that golden chain of teachers that they talk about a lot in yoga, because like in some ways, the crystals are holding this information that then us as like modern humans have both the lens of our spiritual practice and then also the lens of the science that are, you know, really able to find this synergy in this field and this study. And you present this in a way that it's just, yeah, like I said, peak science witch, because it is taking both what we know from the science and bringing it into a spiritual practice, which I think is, again, just this is the world we witches want, right? That spirituality and science can both meet, inspire, and be in sync with one another, as opposed to being opposing.
Actually, yeah, just a little context, and I had to look up the ephemeris because I was like, oh, I think this is right, but I wasn't sure. I think I'm really interested in the fact that you started this book in 2018, because that's right when Uranus entered into Taurus. So like the most archetypical sign of Earth, and Uranus bringing science and bringing the cutting edge and bringing the old into the new in weird and wonderful ways. And now, as you're releasing the book, it's starting to transit into an ingress back and forth a little bit into Gemini. And we'll be in Uranus and Gemini for 7 years. So it's all about like releasing the word and the conversation and the ideas and the thoughts. So I don't know if you are thinking about planetary transits and Uranus in your arc there, but it tracks really well.
It was completely a process of surrender. Authors have remarkably little say over when and how things get published when they use the traditional publishing model. So and I'm glad for it. If the stars were aligning to conspire with me, that's wonderful.
Yeah, I mean, yeah. Taking the jewels of the earth and writing about them and sharing that knowledge broadly is just, this Uranus transit is just, I feel like is some good wind behind your sails or under your wings here, or whatever metaphor makes sense there. Maybe since it's Uranus, whatever wind is behind your drone, I don't know, Uranus is out there.
What were you going to say, Angel?
Well, I was going to ask back to your book, what are the techniques that you find yourself incorporating most often, and which ones have you found that the folks that have been, you know, asking for this book and looking for this book have really found a lot of resonance with?
Yeah, this is I think a really great way to make it practical. So I'm a big believer in a couple of things, which usually line up, but sometimes are at odds with one another. One is keeping your practice simple enough that it can be a recurrent practice. Both frequency and regularity are really useful, particularly when it comes to the realm of protection or psychic self-defense. So there's like a host of really simple things that you're going to find, whether it's just simply wearing crystals or using, you know, the kind of foundational techniques of psychic shielding. This is something I do on a daily basis. I will usually kind of stack those two things together. So I've got the physical embodiment of the kind of shield that I'm working with. So I'm wearing some labradorite right now, and that is a frequent ally when I go out into the world. There's a few practices in the book that make use of labradorite, but the one I default to the most is this kind of psychic shield where you envision, you construct this layer of labradorite energy around you, and it serves as a kind of selectively permeable membrane which filters out the things we don't want to receive. It helps us release the things we don't want to hold on to and gives us a fair and, we'll say, just exchange of other energies. You know, there's so many shielding practices where you're taught to create something that is impenetrable, that is just so solid and unbreathable. And, you know, the great analogy is what happens when you seal up that bag of spinach in your fridge. It gets off real fast.
Yeah.
Give it something breathable, it's gonna last longer. So
yeah.
I think there's probably a lot of little things like that in the kind of greater body of spiritual practice, whether we are witchy folks or woo-woo folks or whatever. There's certainly some ways that we can kind of redirect and refocus. The other kind of techniques that are in the book that can work more passively are things like gridding your house, whether that is a large scale grid or something we shrink down to the size of a single room. So like, you know, the house that I'm in now has a couple of those nestled in it. Having a diverse range of techniques that you can draw from is also useful, because as much as we need the regularity, the rhythm of a recurring practice, there are situations that arise that call for different things. If someone learns how to pick the lock to your front door, locking the door every night is insufficient. You need to install a deadbolt. You need to add an alarm system. You need to have other layers to this. It might not be that you need to arm all of the things all of the time, but they need to be options that are available to you. And that's where this other kind of component comes in. It's not just regularity and simplicity that allows you to do it all the time. It's having some other tools at your disposal. And, you know, that can be just mixing up the crystals that you carry, or using different kinds of psychic shields on different days, or having the grids. But it could also be the more kind of ritual practices, like the banishing techniques, the binding techniques, and other things that are in the book. I'd say, as far as my general audience goes, I think more people interface with those kind of simpler everyday techniques, the spiritual hygiene practices of cleansing and clearing and grounding and centering, the shielding practices, and then the more portable uses for gems. But I'm hopeful that they will never need the heavier hitting stuff that's in there, but it's there anyway, because the reality is sometimes life sucks. And having at least one tool at your disposal when things get heavy is really important to me.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
One of the ways that I've been using crystals in my practice has been for my yoga practice. I use them as a way to open up our practice. So before we start the actual asanas, the poses, we sit in meditation with our crystals. And depending on the crystal you work with is what you want to utilize. And then during the meditation practice, where we're sitting there in mindful connection with our breath and body, we program an intention into the crystal. And then you carry that crystal with you as sort of a reminder of that. And I found that to be very powerful, of bringing crystals and crystal protection into my yoga practice as a way to have the extra crystal protection, and also to have that space and time of carving out to have a regular practice. Because, yeah, being ADHD, it's really hard for me to have a regularity in doing something every single day. And so with having yoga as my template and container for this, it really helps to also have that crystal. And I found that people seem to really like that, especially on my online classes where I teach over Facebook Live and then I teach over Zoom, and people have been really starting to resound with having that crystal. So yeah, I think that's a really good way of bringing people into these practices in a way that's accessible, and not, we're not like doing the, you know, lesser banishing ritual of the pentagram every single time we need to shield and stuff, which I think it's a powerful ritual, but at times it can seem, wow, that's a lot, that's extra. And so this is sort of a way to make it accessible and easy to folks. And yeah, I appreciate that.
I had
Go
some
ahead and continue.
underified personal gnosis around yoga and crystals. A few months ago, I had a dream where a yoga instructor in my dream told me or gave me a rainbow moonstone to carry. And this will help with your flexibility. Just carry this around. So I try to carry that with me when I remember. I also have the ADHD is pretty heavy, so I don't always remember, but I do try to have it with me when I'm doing yoga or stretching. Oh, I'm actually curious. One question for Nicholas here about this kind of practice of carrying stones with you. How important, Nicholas, do you think it is for it to have like skin to stone contact? I know for safe stones, I know not all stones are really appropriate for that, but for, our jaspers or our that we can carry, do you recommend that people, if I have it in my pocket while I'm doing yoga, is that as effective as if I have it on a bracelet that's like touching my skin, that kind of thing?
Yeah, so this is one of those topics that the answer you get is going to vary on the model that you're using for how and why crystals work. So, if we are practicing Vedic gem therapy, which is rooted in the principles of Jyotish Vedic astrology, they really emphasize the necessity of the gems you're wearing not having a back when they're in the ring, so they touch skin. But there are other practices that I work with that are completely at odds with that. And if we use a model, an energetic model that has to follow similar rules to electromagnetism, I'm not suggesting that crystal energy is electromagnetism. If so, we could detect it in ways we don't currently. But if it's an energy, it ought to follow similar rules as other energies we can measure. And if that is the case, then if they are in the radius around me, they're doing their job. My electromagnetic field, also assuming that there are subtle energies, vital forces we have yet to map out and cannot quite quantify just yet, they should behave in similar manners. If that crystal is therefore in my field, it's doing its job. Proximity, I think, is helpful when we have targeted practices. If we are trying to localize the effects on a particular part of our body or part of our psyche that we map out onto our physical or non-physical anatomy, then of course, getting it in just that spot is useful. However, having it around you is more effective than not having it around you at all. So whether it's in the pocket, beads around your wrist, sitting on your desk, I've got rocks right in front of me that are most certainly within the radius of my electromagnetic field. They're doing something. And also tied to this is the idea of like, well, what about size? What about quality? What about this shape or that shape? How much of this really matters? And again, it's going to come back to the model we default to. I like thinking in terms of electromagnetism, even if I can't prove that has anything to do with crystal energy. We see crystals interact with large swaths of the electromagnetic field in really regular and predictable ways. So we can anticipate that unseen and unmeasurable subtle energies follow similar kinds of rules. And, size is great, but bigger isn't better. It's just louder. We can think amplitude being a function of mass to a certain extent. Frequency is also a function of mass. If we use, metaphors from acoustics, you go to a harp and you pluck the string with the most mass, in other words, the longest one, it has the lowest frequency as opposed to the string with the least amount of mass, and so on and so forth. So there are lots of nuanced ways we can have these conversations, but fundamentally get the crystal on or near you and it's doing something. And then if you've got a practice that necessitates localizing or concentrating that, then do that in some way. I love the skin-to-skin contact when I wear something like rhodonite, which I frequently have as beads around my neck. I find it a really emotionally grounding stone, and I get that tangible reminder. Do I need it to make contact to have an energetic effect? No, but it's a really powerful psychological reminder. If I'm wearing it on the outside of my shirt, I don't feel it necessarily, and I might forget that it's there. And at the end of the day, since we can't measure subtle energies, I can't prove that's working, but I do know the placebo effect is important. And if that becomes a tangible metaphor for the outcome I'm seeking, whatever tool is going to get me interacting with that metaphor, that symbol, that reminder is going to do its job. So if the pocket is doing it, you're doing it right. But if you find that skin to skin is going to do it better, or skin to stone, I guess in this case, then use that.
Nice. Oh, and while we're talking sort of very nuts and bolts, Angel mentioned programming crystals. I wonder if you can speak a little bit about your perspective on that and, when, how, why, maybe why not in certain cases.
Yeah, so this idea of programming crystals, that term in application to crystals was coined by a gentleman by the name of Marcel Vogel, who would certainly eschew any kind of witchy or occulty title, but I think he embodies a lot of the same principles of science witch, in as much that he was a pedigreed, credentialed scientist, had like a collection of honorary degrees given to him because he just went out and did science, and people are like, hey, let's make him sound more official. He worked for IBM for decades. If you use a liquid crystal display at all, he invented them. He coined the term liquid crystal mesophase. We only know about liquid crystals because he studied them. But
Wow.
he went on to become the father of the modern crystal healing movement. And
Whoa.
background in computer science kind of carried over in his terminology, and that's where you get this idea of programming. And for him, programming is very much, we'll say, in installing a set of instructions in a crystal. But this is, again, there's really nothing new out there. This is something we find in so many other practices in a more, we'll say, kind of witchy folk magic sense. We often talk about charging our magical ingredients, materia magica, and this idea of charging isn't like we associate with our modern devices. Oh, the battery is running out, I plug it back in. But it comes from charge, meaning to endow with a set of instructions. You charge something with the responsibility of carrying out your goals. And so charging becomes the ritual act of essentially partnering with the intelligence of your tools, your allies. They aren't just objects or ingredients, but they're spirit helpers. At least I live in animist and inspirited worlds, and so that metaphor tracks for me. But programming is just modern day lingo referring to the same kind of practice. And so I think for the most part, crystals always work better when programmed, mostly because humans always work better when we have a finite task in front of us. And the best programming techniques don't just program the crystal, they program us too. Again, can we separate placebo effect from any of this? No, we can't. But what little material has been, properly studied in blind settings demonstrates that crystals can outperform placebos. There's got to be something to it, however mysterious the mechanism is to science. And the goal behind programming can look different for different situations. It can be as simple as, when I pick up the bracelet I'm going to wear for the day, it's freshly cleansed, and I just sit and reflect about what my goals are for it. So my labradorite is there to help me essentially filter out what doesn't serve while also helping my light shine its brightest. And I can just think about that in really symbolic terms. I can also enter into a more, we'll say, ritualized structure where I'm focusing on that goal. I might associate it with a short word or phrase or affirmation. I might associate it with something visual or some other kind of sensory input. Not everyone visualizes the same way, so use what you got and somehow transmit that to the crystal. The breath is a really powerful medium for this. It's the one that Marcel used. It's the one that you find a lot of indigenous cultures using breath as a means of, we'll say, carrying intention, carrying power. But you can also really live in that imaginal space and just have a conversation with your allies and say, hey, Labradorite, it's good to see you again. Here's how I'm feeling today. Can you help me navigate the world like this? Maybe you hear a voice back, maybe you don't. You don't have to, but when we think about programming, I don't think of it in terms of the kind of mechanical materialist view of the universe. I am doling out a set of instructions. I'm installing a computer program into, new software into my hardware. It is entering into relation with my tools. And that's a two-way street. That means I'm also upholding my end of the bargain. I don't say it's your job to keep me safe and then walk into traffic blindfolded on a busy day. I look both ways before I cross the street.
Thank you for the explanation of charging, because I definitely, especially on like full moon rituals or new moon rituals, have had that maybe sort of implicitly, like I'm charging my battery on my phone. And so that's a really helpful reframe. And I think you and we have talked about this in previous times. We've talked on the podcast about the placebo effect. So if that's something listeners are interested in, they can go back to that one. But just to really highlight, I think so often that is used as a pejorative, and they focus on the idea of placebo as if it's a non-effect, but it is an effect. And just right. by like hand waving and certain types of materialist science, just sort of like shooing that away as nothing. Yeah, I think just misses so much. So I'm glad that you really lean into that. And, you know, we can think about crystals in so many multifaceted ways, but like the idea of it being like a heuristic. Oh, when I have my selenite, I remember the power of friendship, right? Like that is real, even if there was nothing else behind it. And I'm, you know, so just throwing it out there, like, yeah, I'm glad that you walk that line and you explain it really well.
I can't remember if it was Terence McKenna or Timothy Leary that says, it's all in your head, but your head's a lot bigger than you think. And that's...
Yeah.
When you say the placebo effect, and I totally agree, people use it as a pejorative, but isn't it the same thing as people who say the power of positive thinking? Or, you know, I feel like we have different names for the same idea.
I find it interesting that when science wants to attribute power to it, we call it things like positive mental affect. And when we want to, you know, disparage it, then it's the placebo effect, even though.
Are there certain crystals that protect against specific kinds of harmful or disruptive energies?
For sure. And I'll start by saying that, you know, individual preference and experience and circumstances, of course, come into this. But you know, historically, recent history and not so recent history, we do see some trends emerge. So we're going to find, I think, some gemstones that have kind of broad spectrum effects. These could be something like, you know, maybe our black tourmalines, our labradorites, our smoky quartzes, hematite. And then we're also going to find things that might be a little bit more specialized in their activities. So for someone who's really sensitive to this idea of geopathic stress, of how disruptive forces emanate from the earth, the landscape, the structures they're on that might be somehow influencing its natural flow of energy, we could look to something like certain kinds of jaspers or shungite is a really great example of one that people turn to for this. I'm really fond of Pressily Bluestone, which comes from Mynyth Pressily in Pembrokeshire in Wales. I've got a little carved gazing hair right here by my computer to keep me company all the time, made out of that. I'm usually wearing a pendant of Pressily Bluestone as well. It's just so nourishing with the kind of uplifting earthy energies to overcome whatever that malaise is that we're experiencing. But then there's also, you know, what about disruptive emotions that come from other people, intentionally or not? They're out there. What about people who are very intentionally trying to send icky vibes our way? We've got stones that help in these situations too. And some of them are maybe rooted in specific cultural contexts. So for example, in the ancient Near East and farther away through the trade routes with it, we see applications of, for example, lapis lazuli against the evil eye. But you know, if you go to some other part of the world where they had no access to that, there's another gem in its place that performs a similar function. So we can, in the modern era, when we live in a very globalized and a very connected kind of world, we can draw on rich symbolism and lore and tradition from all over, hopefully respectfully and reciprocally, but I know that's not always the case. And we can try to pair our situation with the crystal or crystals that best match it. And that's why the book has as many as it had. When I originally pitched it, it was 75 crystals. And very rapidly, I knew that was insufficient. So it became 100 and then like 120. It ballooned briefly to like 160 plus. And then I was aiming for 150, but my final count was like 144. And I thought, I'm going to add one more. I'm just going to pull one B-side and we'll stop at 145. And that became the magic number. But there's something in there for just about anything you're going to experience, even if you have to get a little bit creative.
I like what you were saying about the availability of certain gemstones and crystals, depending on, you were saying, what's around you in your ancient trade routes and things like that, because something I am working on is feeling connected to the land I was born in and the land that I live in. So it's, I'd really like to use local resources as much as possible, because it's, this is where I am from.
This is a big part of my practice these days, a huge part of it. So in the course of writing this book, I really started to have bigger and more uncomfortable conversations related to the ethics of mining and extraction.
Sure.
At, you know, big scale. The healing crystal industry is a multi-billion dollar industry. It is also still probably the smallest sector of all mining and extraction compared to all the other applications, the technological, the infrastructural and architectural and so on and so forth. But that doesn't mean, well, since it's the smallest sector, it doesn't matter. It right. just that like maybe don't scapegoat us to feel better about all the things you're ignoring, because there are additional atrocities out there and we should make it better across the board.
Of course.
Unfortunately, that's not how most people do this. It's much easier to do the performative thing and scapegoat what they don't view as a necessity in life. But amidst all of this, I have really done a big pivot in my practice more towards the concept of georegionalism. What is nearby? What has the lowest environmental and economic and social and, you know, other impact? And it's the stones I can find in my backyard. Now in Florida, they might not be exciting to the average person. If we widen that scope to more than just my backyard, I can find more than limestone here. But that also means that when you travel, you can get to know the rocks where you're going. You can connect to the energies of the bedrock and the basement rock beneath that. And those energy forces are always there. Whether or not you're holding a tiny fragment of it or not, it's still influencing you. So the book has a lot of really common rocks, flint and chalk and granite and slate, because I want people to know there's magic in your landscape without you having to buy this rare thing that is potentially implicated in some ethical nightmares or at least ethical gray area. There are still options for you. And then on top of that, the book is also informed by the places I've been. So I had this really magical adventure to England. My best friend and my husband, and we led this retreat in Southwest Great Britain. And it was just so magical. So there are a lot of weird British rocks in here that are maybe slightly less available on this side of the pond, although some of them you can still find with relative ease thanks to the internet. And just spending time getting to know the spirit of place is so enriching. When we add the kind of geologic layer to that and find out what has been mined, what has been used by Indigenous peoples, what is an important part of the local industry and, you know, the history of your local economy, chances are mining and extraction are some piece of that puzzle. And if not, it's you don't have to move too far from home to see what mineral resources have driven where you live. And it's so fun to just collect a piece of that. You know, Florida's got plenty of fossils, so I've got those in my collection. But when I travel, I try to get other fun things. So you never know what you might find, depending on where you live.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I think in some ways, the crystals and minerals are the living embodiment of the genus Loci. Here in Oregon, one of our state stone, and one of the things that's the easiest to go rock hounding for is sunstones, which are these beautiful little, they're quartz-based crystals that you can easily get. There's several sunstone mining areas where you can do pretty low impact extraction processes. And I know Arizona is just like a rock hound paradise. There's just so many places you can go to get so many incredible crystals like peridot. There's a really cool place to go get peridot. There's, you know,
where
all
at?
Kinds of, it's on the reservation, so you got to get permission, but they're tiny little flecks. Most of the time the tribe is like, all right, whatever, just don't start chipping into the ground. But you could just get it like on the ground, and they're just tiny little little flecks of peridot.
Cool.
There's a quality to both understanding the mineral from the perspective of where it is geo-regionally, but then also this is the genus loci, the sort of living embodiment of that. And so I like that. I like that idea. And then, having a giant library of different crystals you can utilize is good because then you can sort of see what's around you and available before you start looking into getting something that is found somewhere else and has a provenance that may be ethically dubious.
Ooh,
So
Angel,
yeah, that's
what were those amazing stones? I have them several all over that we collected on the beach up in the Pacific Northwest. It's like a brownish or a ruddy brown
Jasper.
with white striations. That is a jasper.
Yes, yeah,
Those are
Jaspers.
jaspers.
Yeah,
Oh
those
my
are
gosh.
Jaspers. Those are
I just love them. And yeah, and they have a story for us, right? When we go out and collect them and like can hold those and be back at Thor's Anvil or whatever it's called, just
Thor as well.
immediately Thor's Well, thank you so much. Just by holding and connecting with it. And it feels different to me from my other jaspers. A range of jaspers are kind of my go-tos. And yeah, I don't even really think of these as jaspers because to me they have like a really individualized energy because of that story that or that our story together. That when I'm holding one of my tumbled picture jaspers, it feels different, you know.
Yeah, I that having that story with a crystal that you use in your practice, I think is also really powerful. Also, in this book, you kind of pivoting a little bit about talking about some of the topics that you don't usually see in crystal healing is hauntings and binding and curses. And we talked a little bit about curses and bindings, but with hauntings, one of the things that we've been developing and talking, especially with J. Allen Cross, is this idea of hauntings, paranormal being an extension of human trauma that's unresolved in a space. And you see echoes of what is paranormal, uncanny things happening to people and generational trauma being passed down. And our sort of science witch theory is that paranormal is sort of linked to that. So, with that in mind, how do you think crystals and crystal healing fits into this idea of the paranormal being a non-physically embodied form of the trauma that a place or a that's being haunted experiences?
Yeah, so I think there's a few layers to this. Back in, I want to say, late 70s, 80s, somewhere around there was this idea put forth called the stone tape theory that, talks about how the actual rock that buildings are made from almost is like a, I mean, everything was analog in those days, is like a tape recorder and is kind of imprinted with the echoes of the past within it. There was a solid state chemist and materials scientist by the name of Don Robbins who extrapolated further from that with his background in crystallography. He kind of refined that and he wrote a book on it called The Secret Language of Stone. And he is largely focusing on this idea of hauntings and paranormal phenomena. And I think there's a lot of validity to the fact that spaces imprint with what happens in them. But I don't think it's the only cause. I think, like most things in life, it's complicated. I have met a lot of people over the years, particularly working in the kind of esoteric witchy retail sector, and I usually get to go under the radar. People don't really know who I am when I'm doing that, and that is purposeful wherever possible. I've met a lot of people who swear that they are being visited by a spirit, or there is a haunting, or there is a curse, and generally, in most of these cases, whether they really are experiencing this as a discrete phenomenon or they only believe it, the remedy is the same. So, whether we attribute this to some sort of psychological state or projection or some sort of spiritual phenomena or something else entirely, going through similar ritual activities can remediate the experience. There is, an asterisk with a footnote, and it should be a really meaty footnote that says, except it won't fix it when people don't really want it to be fixed. Because I've also met those people who come in, they've got the quick fix because they don't have the bandwidth for anything more complicated. Maybe it's, finding the right cleansing herb and the right crystal to help them feel safe, and it's good for a couple weeks, a month, 2 months top, and then they're right back saying, "Oh, it's back." I'm like, "Oh, is it really? Was it really ever there?" I'm not the expert in their lived experience. I can't tell them. That's also not my job in that space to tell them. But the truth is that because this is so nuanced, I think we can address a few layers at a time. From that animistic and spirited view of the universe, I believe consciousness survives beyond death. I don't have a model for how and why that works, and it also, in my experience, isn't identical in every case. So we're gonna meet some forces that are not embodied, and those can be the source of some of these phenomena. Historically, gems have been used for things like this for thousands of years. Some things like jet or burned, because it is an organic compound. It's a bunch of organic compounds. It's a type of fossilized wood. It is something that people use the smoke to drive things away. Emeralds were once thought, even just brought into a space, could cast out unclean spirits. We've got things like chiastolite and staurolite, which form in these kind of twin formations. I've got some staurolite here for the host of the show to see. They also have this association of protection and driving away the things that go bump in the night. But other things had more kind of symbolic uses. Other things worked maybe more on the psychological components of that. So we can address where in myself am I feeling the most activated or triggered by this. Again, not trying to put blame onto the person having the experience, because that's seldom helpful, especially when we're not in the right kind of therapeutic relationship together. Like, I'm not your therapist, I'm not your counselor, I'm not here to tell you that you're doing this. But as someone who's, maybe short-term guide in the spiritual, where inside you do you feel most activated by this experience around you? And then we can deal with the external, but we can also bring that internal part. And this often comes in the form of introspection. So maybe we're going to work with stones that have a really reflective quality to them, like moonstone, like obsidian, that help us examine what's going on in the subconscious. Maybe we're going to work with crystals that help us feel a little less triggered, things that help us find a sense of emotional stability amidst an ever-changing world. So we're going to look at things like maybe rhodonite that add a little sense of ballast there, or jade to help us cultivate a sense of peace in a chaotic world. And then also maybe we're going to address things purely from that energetic level. So maybe we're not going to attribute it to a discarnate entity. Maybe we're not going to all blame it on the kind of psychological and the trauma and that model. Maybe we're also going to just view it as an energetic phenomenon going on. Then we're going to look at our strongly cleansing stones. These can be our aquamarines, our halite and salts and sulfur salt minerals. They're going to be things like fluorite and selenite and other kinds of things that have this kind of energetic quality of purging, cleansing, clearing, and ultimately aligning, because the human experience is multivalent. No phenomenon, no situation, I think, exists only one on one level at a time. And having more than one tool in our toolbox allows us to address the individual needs. There are absolutely people that I've met that tell me their story, and I'm like, "Oh, you're not here to make a paranormal phenomenon go away. You are here because telling this story, having this experience, is the only way that gets you seen. I don't want to create a situation where, because it is driven by capitalism, of course, working in retail, having these kinds of conversations largely, I don't want people to feel obligated to continue spending money to feel seen. What I really want is for them to find the tool that helps them feel seen and to use it in perpetuity.
Totally.
Because it's so easy for the lines between these things to be blurred. And that is why I like the anonymity of doing that kind of job. I often work more behind the scenes than I do like out on the sales floor kind of thing. And then it also kind of keeps a little professional distance between that and like the writing, teaching, other stuff that I do, although they're obviously related. The expertise in one carries over to the other. But I feel like if people are approaching me because they know my work, then there are also some expectations about what our relationship might look like.
And I think where we are and we find ourselves in this moment, the more tools we can have for people to both feel safe and seen is one of those things that's part of this, overall intention we've been having with, especially this past year on the podcast, is this is how we find our magic. This is how we find our joy. This is how we feel empowered in a world that often feels very, but we feel very powerless on. There's just so many things happening. And then Inku actually had brought up this idea about disentangling sensitive from fragile. Like, Inku, do you want to talk about that a little bit and develop that on
Yeah,
what you were thinking?
there's some like dichotomies I've been just sort of playing around with lately, and spending too much time in online spaces and too much time dealing with trolls.
Do it
And
as little as possible these days.
well, I've been in a local group, and so I'm trying to engage with my neighbors, and I need to
Sure.
step back and not engage with certain neighbors for a while, but I'm glad that I had the experience, and we're form it's not even to change those neighbors' mind, but to have a record of when this person says that I don't even want to continue with that statement,
Sure.
that someone was there to say no. No, and let's just keep. I feel
Emphatically
like it's
no.
important for those of us who have the capacity and the bandwidth to engage with those, maybe even in short terms. I think that that can be important work. I'm not going to change the fascist specifically, but like when my Muslim friend goes on and sees that, they will see that someone said no. And I think that that is an
Extremely
important practice
important
right now,
that.
but it's also really harmful if we stay in it too long.
Yes,
And so
but
I've been
extremely
thinking.
important to, like you're saying, show that you're showing up for your friends who are in a marginalized space. It's partly combating the words that are being said, but it's partly just the act of showing up. Like when people are making ableist remarks or people are making fatphobic remarks or whatever it is, someone should be pushing back against those things, even if they're not going to change the mind of the person who said them.
Like I know when I see violently homophobic stuff online, and there's no pushback against it. It's the lack of pushback that freaks me out, right?
Exactly.
Like I know there are people out there who want all sorts of negative things for me and all of the people that I love. Anyway, totally tangent, getting off crystals. So I've been playing with the idea in just from those experiences of the dichotomy between like sensitivity and fragility. And since like a lot of us in the spiritual community take on the label, or we use sensitive to describe ourselves, and that gets weaponized against us as fragility. And I think sometimes that line between sensitivity and fragility can be fuzzy even within ourselves. And so, or like sensitivity versus just collapse, right? So I've been playing with the idea of vibrant and resilient sensitivity. And yeah, Nicholas, taking it back to crystals, I wonder, how you might approach that from the modalities that you work in, especially sort of crystal magic, or like, do you have a Troll Be Gone crystal? Because I could use a Troll Be Gone crystal sometimes.
A really, really, really heavy one, preferably with at least one sharp edge. I live in your neighborhood. I mean, if these are neighborhood trolls. No, but in all seriousness, this kind of space where sensitivity is weaponized, I think the first people, for those of us who've been labeled sensitive, who have had that used against us, the first person to use it against us is usually ourselves.
God, it's so real. Or our parents.
Right. We learn by
We learned
example.
it from somebody.
But as a grown-up who allows sensitivity to rule their lives, you stand to miss out on so much. And I say this from experience. And I got some great advice from my friend Dan Lupacino some years ago. He also identifies as an empath and counsels a lot of folks. And one day, I don't even remember what we were talking about, but I was just, I was fried. And he said to me, "Nicholas, I'm going to give you the advice that I only give my really long-term clients, the people I know really well. Are you ready?" I'm like, "Yes." Dan says, "Mind your own fucking business. If you are sensitive and you walk into the grocery store, other people's stuff is none of your business."
Totally.
For that sensitive, you need to be equally as skilled in applying that sensitivity. A scanning electron microscope is super duper sensitive, but only to the things that you prepare adequately and put inside that sealed vacuum chamber. So like, it's not just scanning everything, every surface in the room around it. It is applied sensitivity. It is skillful. What separates the sensitive that has the ability to navigate that space and the one who is tied to this concept of fragility, where that sensitivity can be weaponized, is just someone who knows where to tune the station. You know, if we go back to the ancient and mystical era when all devices actually had analog buttons and dials and knobs.
Right.
Ancient history. But if we go back to that era, we don't think of our car stereos as being sensitive devices, but they really were quite sensitive.
You were
in exactly the right position, and you had to be within a certain radius from the antenna broadcasting the signal to receive it. And if something was on the radio you didn't like, you just could adjust the knob and that was it. Yeah. If you're experiencing a response through your own sensitivity to what's happening in your space, and you find it harmful, you find it disruptive, you find it whatever, the goal should not be, "I need an external tool to fix this. Let me go grab my crystal." The goal should be, "Oh, how do I disengage with this? How do I change the dial on the radio?" And there are crystals that can help us learn that behavior, that can help us, we'll say, install that kind of filter. I've mentioned labradorite several times. I think this might be a good time to do a deeper dive into why the energetic mechanics of labradorite are really helpful for this. So when we see a piece, and I have a big piece that's usually on my desk, but it's packed up from...
Your bracelet though, right? Yeah.
Bracelet, and you can kind of see on camera, and I'll describe it for everyone listening to the podcast. Labradorite has a kind of shimmery iridescence that is revealed from inside it when the orientation of incident light, of incoming light, hits it from just the right angle. And this is due to a really interesting kind of composition and structure. Two things are linked in this case. And labradorite belongs to the feldspar family and forms in essentially as an intermediate between two closely related species. One is sodium rich, the other one is potassium rich. I think I've got the right ends of the triangle. It might be the other way around. But anyway, because these two slightly different compositions do not bend light in exactly the same way, their molecules are not exactly the same, they form in distinct layers called laminae, like the word to laminate, and those layers bond together. Now, the relative thickness or thinness of these individual laminae influence what happens to light coming through. So if you have a really nice, clearish, gemmy piece of this, like the beads in my bracelet, light can pass through all the way, but specific wavelengths are going to be filtered out. Those wavelengths are actually going to correspond to the size of those layers that act like in microns. They're roughly equivalent to the wavelength getting filtered out. So it's like a diffusion grating, diffraction grating. I think it's the latter, diffraction grating. And energetically, that's kind of what's happening with a stone like labradorite. It's not saying, "All right, I'm so sensitive, I have to block everything." It's about learning to filter out what is useful. It's in training you to engage with the things that are going to uplift you, that are going to nourish you, that are going to teach you something valuable, which doesn't always feel good, but it's important. And learning how to let everything else just roll off like
water off a duck's back.
Right, exactly. So it stands at this interesting threshold that does that. But simultaneously, we don't just see labradorite selectively filter out one wavelength or another and go, oh, yeah, okay. We look at it and there's a kind of awe-inspiring quality when we see that beautiful iridescent sheen that appears from within. It takes ordinary light and it scrambles and remixes it to do something quite extraordinary. And when we learn to harness our sensitivity in a meaningful way and we disengage from that kind of weaponized sensitivity that makes us feel overvulnerable, then our light shines more brilliantly. We become more fully realized humans, more fully realized witches, occultists, practitioners, more fully realized in whatever it is we're applying that sensitivity to. And that is the real magic of labradorite. Yes, it's great to filter out what doesn't help us, but we're actually also filtering from within. We are redirecting that light so it's not always in this contracted state and we allow it to shine. And the secret here is that the best protection is actually an open heart. And when we've had our sensitivity weaponized against us, we want to wall it off. We want to shut down in many cases when things get uncomfortable. And labradorite says, actually, from that space, we can't grow. From that space, we can't find the hope. We can't mine for gold. We have to do this meaningfully. And sometimes that does mean like retreating. You don't have to engage with trolls when you have no spoons left. Like, don't.
Just don't.
But when you've got them, maybe pick the low-hanging fruit. Maybe have the conversation that is easiest to have, or the one that will have the greatest impact. Or maybe redirect your focus in other ways. Like I can't change my terrible neighbor, but I can put the signs in my front lawn that show my other neighbors who feel marginalized that they're welcome with me. There's so many ways that we can redirect that focus without having to fall into the trap of being the sensitive empath who's overwhelmed by other people's vibes. Quite simply, other people's vibes are none of your business until you both consent.
I feel like all of what you just said is such good advice of exactly what Science Witch podcast is about, right? Use your best judgment, go to therapy, do things other than just relying on your crystal, but also you can add that into your practice.
Yeah, and that's I think a good place to start wrapping it up for this wonderful, very insightful talk. Thank you, Nicholas, again for coming back on the show for a third time, and I'm sure we'll have you on again. Before we close out the recording, was there anything else you want to let our listeners know about that you are working on currently and we can look forward to seeing and bringing you back on the show about?
Oh, thank you. Yes, it's my pleasure to join you as always. I'm always busy, so there's always a new project or three. So Crystals for Psychic Self-Defense just came out in January of this year. It is my ninth release. In October of this year, my 10th book comes out and it is called The Witching Stones. And takes us through 13 chapters, mostly devoted to a single stone each. There's a couple exceptions to the rule that combines the geology, the folklore, and the practice all in one. And one of my editors has referred to it as my magnum opus, which is really humbling. So freaking excited for this book. This was like one of those ideas that I didn't have space to pursue when it came to me. But I'm glad I held on to it, and it's coming out pretty soon. Next spring, I'll have another book that I co-authored with a really dear friend and colleague on crystal divination. More details forthcoming. And I am currently writing my 12th book, so this one is due to my publisher sometime middle of next year. So I've got ample space for it. I'm not quite halfway through just yet, but it is an exploration of the ritual elements of the system of Reiki. It does a lot of heavy lifting in each chapter. Each chapter is devoted to a single practice. So we look at it from a morphological perspective, from a cultural and historical perspective. We look at how we have this kind of one trunk of the tree that has many branches, and what feels like people in places and time periods in just the scant 100 plus years of Reiki's development, they still could not have shared ideas. They still come up with similar tools and techniques and similar inspirations. We've got this, like, so many wonderful examples of convergent evolution in, you know, 104-year-old practice by the time I finish writing the book. It's so inspiring to me to see the similarities in the family tree like that. So this is what I'm in the middle of right now, and I am hopefully gonna get the 9th chapter done before the end of this month.
Nice.
And I would also really like to, in addition to your written work, and you mentioned some of your other modalities, I'd really like to plug your website, which we'll have in the show notes, but it's theluminouspearl.com. And I know you're often giving classes and events both locally and online. And so, you know, if people are more into engaging with the kind of work you do beyond the written word, or you're gracing so many podcasts and other folk with your presence, that's a recommendation that I would make, is for people to follow what you do and plug in, because you're doing a lot of good work outside of just 12 books.
Thank you. Yeah. If anyone's thinking keep up with me, the website's kind of your all-in-one stop. It's got media appearances, current and upcoming books. My workshop calendar's on there. You can sign up for my newsletter, and I promise not to spam you because I hate writing it. I hate things, so I never want to do that to someone else. It's not that I hate writing the newsletter. It's that I hate being a burden. Talk about weaponized sensitivity, right?
But also, we all have notification fatigues. People don't want to get spammed by a newsletter every freaking day.
Big time.
All right. Well, thank you again, Nicholas. I'm sure we'll have you on again to talk about the witching stones. That's a really exciting topic.
I'm excited.
I'm really looking forward to that. But yeah, thank you again for coming on the show. And I'm excited to get this out for our listeners, because I feel like, yeah, this is the hope core that we need right now in the world.
Thank you so much to Nicholas for that wonderful in-depth discussion. We really ran the gamut through a lot of different topics, not just witchiness and crystal magic, but geology, philosophy, anti-capitalism, etc.
Yeah, and I'm sure he'll be on for a fourth time to talk about one of his next very exciting projects.
No doubt.
So, yeah, stay tuned for that. Now it's time to check in with our monetary support structure for the podcast, Patreon. Joining and supporting us at Patreon helps us with the incidental costs of producing the podcast and gives us a container to deliver our myriad talents for our listeners. At the $1 a month level, you'll get access to our bonus episodes from our short form series, Who's in Bloom, DD Deep Dives, and Tripping Through the Tarot, along with bonus Patreon-only episodes we only release to this platform. This is also where you can access videos from my yoga practice, which I record and post only on Patreon. Finally, this is a great way to access ad-free early episodes that we post a day before the main RSS feed. It's only $1 a month, and we're always scheming up new things to share via this platform, including an up-and-coming new podcast series featuring my partner Rick and I called Movies from Whenever, where we watch a movie I've never seen and talk about it. Ruby is currently working on our intro music for the episodes, and we'll be releasing them on our Patreon at this tier once they are ready.
At the $5 level, you will get mail. And by mail, we mean stickers from our sticker exchange. Angel sent out a mail barrage last month, so this month we're updating our stickers and working on the next sticker project to be released. But if you're interested in getting mail periodically from us, you can join at this level. Also, if you want to get stickers and not pay a monthly subscription, our Etsy is back up, and you can get stickers of your favorite deities, including Isis, Hecate, and Freya.
Finally, at our highest level of support, the Science Witch Coven, you will get access to my tarot practice and or get a birth chart reading from me with Inku's input. I am booking 30-minute sessions over Zoom for tarot readings or chart readings. So if you're interested, reach out over Patreon or via email to book your slot if you're a supporter at this tier. This is a way for us to keep our astrological and tarot skills sharp and provide this insight to our listeners who are members at this level.
And of course, listening and sharing the podcast is an invaluable way to spread our Science Witch agenda with your friends and family. If you're looking to find community, check out our Discord, where you can chat about different topics, connect with other queerdos, and share memes about the absurdity that is our cursed timeline.
If you want to check us out on social media, we are on Blue Sky as Science Witch Pod and Threads, Facebook, and Instagram as Science Witch Podcasts. Show notes and transcripts are available on our website at sciencewitchpodcast.com. And if you hate social media, you can always email us at questions@sciencewitchpodcast.com. Until next time,
live long and prosper.
And blessed be.